Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
Listen to what I'm saying. That's right. Bring that camera in here a little bit closer.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the stud is here.
All right, let's get her done. It's another Studcast with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. Hey, everybody, I'm David Summers, and here comes the story of wrestling in America as told by the stud, whose family started the profession over 100 years ago. So now, let's step back into the ring and back into time. Let's get wall-to-wall, tree-top tall, with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, hanging out in the Smoky Mountains of Tennessee. Okay, Ron, as we get this one started, we've been getting a lot of great comments on recent Studcast. Fans seem to be enjoying all the different subjects that you're covering in the hidden history lessons. I think they're really cool. A lot of folks are saying it's been very interesting since you started covering the Knoxville cards of the old Southeastern Company, now owned by the Georgia promoters in 1980. And politely commenting on what you think sticks.
Well, I guess, politely is a good word for it, I've been trying to be very polite about it. Fans have been keeping me busy, man, the last couple of weeks. My social media sites, they've blown up. I want to apologize, in fact, for not getting back to everyone. I always do my best, so please forgive me if you don't hear back from me. It's been crazy. But I'm so blessed, man, to have so many friends. That's for sure.
Okay. So I know in the last couple of weeks, you said you have passed 20,000 fans now on your social media sites. That is definitely a lot of friends. Speaking of friends, where are we going to be riding today?
Well, we're going to begin in Tennessee, man. We'll start with discussing another card from Knoxville. This one is going to be on the 4th of July week in 1980. New owners were making a couple of huge moves to try to boost the audience after having only 3,000 fans in that last Studcast, which was an NWA world title match with Harley Race against Mr. Wrestling 2.
Okay, so that 3,000 people, I mean, it doesn't sound so bad for many cities in the country, but I think you said in the last Studcast that just over 1 year earlier in the month of May, 1979, you wrestled Harley twice and had more than 5,000 in attendance for each of those events.
Yeah, that's correct, but it was also before the Knoxville War began. So because the Knoxville card in this Studcast was so much stronger than what they had been doing, and the fact that they had changed their regular night for this event, I think Knoxville and what was happening there is going to make a great subject today for this week's Hidden History Lesson. So fans never had the opportunity, really, to go behind the kayfabe curtain, find out exactly what and why promoters and bookers were thinking when they made mistakes, like the one I think they made on Thursday, July the 3rd, 1980, in the Knoxville Coliseum. So I'm going to take us there today, man, as a matter of fact. So we'll also be looking closely at another Southeastern card. This one is in Southeastern Gulf Coast, where business obviously was on fire down there. We had 7 matches, 3 championship matches, 2 special no DQ matches. We had with the winner of each of those guys going to be getting a shot at the United States Junior Heavyweight Champion Jerry Stubbs. And we had the Big C in the ring for a change. So we're going to be talking about the TV for this card, the one down in the Gulf Coast, the Rosita, three major markets. And after all that, man, if we got time, we're also going to have a learning tree question.
Well, one thing I know is you're cramming a whole bunch of history into these studcasts. I think that's awesome. Okay, so my guess is you're going to be taking us behind the kayfabe curtain first. So are you going to give us the card for the Knoxville event? We're going to do that now?
Yep, I think that's where we'll start, Dave. And in my opinion, this was by far the best Knoxville card that had been put together since I left there 7 months earlier in December of 1979. But a couple of things concerned me. For the first time ever, Knoxville ran on a Thursday night in the Coliseum. And the Booker's influence in that territory had something to do with it. And we're going to discuss those. And we're going to also talk about the card. And I don't know who was in the opening two matches on the card, because the newspaper did not say except that there was two additional matches. So we're going to start with the third match on the card. That was Maniac Mark Lewin versus Lars Anderson. Then Tony Atlas is going to be taking on Baron Von Raske. Two big names here, two big names in that first match I just mentioned. Tommy Rich, special attraction match, facing the extremely dangerous Abdullah the Butcher. And then in the main event, Austin Idol and Mr. Wrestling 2 were going to be in the ring with the world-famous Assassins. And I got to assume Jody Hamilton was one of those, because he lived in Atlanta. So it would make a lot of sense to be using him in that Knoxville territory up there.
You talk about how extremely dangerous Abdullah the Butcher is. I had the opportunity to meet him face-to-face one time, and I had my picture made with him, and he is very menacing-looking, absolutely, and what a big guy. I recognize a lot more names on this card than the others that we've been talking about lately. All right, so what do you think? What is the reason for that?
There were several reasons for it. One reason, to my mind, immediately, in that third match on the card, they had Lars Anderson. Lars had been wrestling partners with Ole Anderson for some time, but not in the Georgia territory, strangely enough. They had not wrestled that much as partners there. Lars wasn't a big figure in Georgia wrestling, but Ole Anderson was. And Ole was not only a star in the ring for the company, but he was probably the best booker that they had that had been in that territory in many years. And when I saw Lars, you know, was on that card, I knew Ole wasn't far behind, and I wasn't wrong. One of the biggest hidden history questions was who was booking in basically all territories all over the world. And it was a well-kept secret who the booker was, and for good reason. Mm-hmm. One being that bookers had no reason for anybody to know they were putting the cards together. And many bookers who wrestled every night had a tendency to put themselves in the main events. And so then they got the biggest payoff for being in that main event, plus an additional big payoff as a booker, basically. You know, that was risky business, man, having a booker in your main event. So your top wrestlers had a hard time dealing with that, especially if they were they suspected that the booker was taking a spot in that main event that could have been their match, right? So they were very, very hesitant to have your booker be booking himself in main events.
Yeah, I understand that absolutely, because, yeah, just being in the broadcasting profession, people kind of look, oh, you're the guy who plans everything, so you're the one who's going to push yourself. So I know exactly what you're talking about. So I have never heard anything about something like that, but it does make sense, especially in the context of talking about it in the wrestling profession. That is definitely a hidden history lesson. All right, did you ever have that problem with your company? It seems like your guys were a little more leveled out.
Well, you know, and basically, no, we didn't have the problem either, because Robert and Bob Armstrong and I, we were always doing the bookers, the booking, right? And since we all three owned part of the company, you know, that took the respect level for all those wrestlers up quite a notch. If you own part of the company and you're booking, they are not going to question whether you're in the main event or not. That's for sure. So Ole Anderson was doing a booking for the Georgia Territory, and he had a lot of respect from Jim Barnett. Jim really respected Ole. I did too. A lot of guys didn't like Ole, but I got along great with Ole. And I know Ole wasn't happy with the small crowds he was getting in the Knoxville Coliseum. So he intentionally opened a business there in 1979 with using his A-team. He had Hulk Hogan was there. Bob Armstrong was there when they very first took over in 1979. He was loading those cards up. And I think he was expecting to draw big crowds right from the very beginning. Then when it didn't happen, after about 3 months in, I think he kind of gave up on Knoxville. And he started booking his B team into the town, which what a mistake that was, obviously. And then being the booker and responsible for the size of the crowds, you know, he was probably not happy that one of his best nights, a Friday night in his territory down there, which he was living in Atlanta and Georgia was his territory. And he wasn't happy with the what he was drawing on Friday night in Knoxville. So he had all these Georgia cities that were closer to Atlanta than the Tennessee city was, and especially if the Tennessee city wasn't drawing, I'm sure he's questioned a whole lot of this. So I'm sure he had something to do with that huge mistake that they made here on this date in July the 3rd to switch Knoxville, which had been a forever Friday night town, to a Thursday night, and that was basically a potential town killer. I think Ole, being mostly responsible for making the night change from Friday to Thursday, I think it scared him so much he went back to using his A-team again because he realized that, gosh, if I'm going to drop out of Friday and start running on a Thursday, I'm going to need a stronger card. But it was basically too little, too late, and even that wasn't enough to pull things out. So the attendance for this July 3rd Thursday night event, even though the next day, July 4th, was a holiday and everybody was off, they had a kid price drop to an all-time low of $1 for kids. Then the house fell from just over 2,000 with a big-name card like we just talked about. So and that was following a disappointing 3,000 for the NWA World Title match with Harley Race the week before on a Friday. So the Knoxville Five and the Knoxville War, they're all over at this point. And still, there was nothing to be optimistic about in Knoxville.
I'll tell you what, this has really been absolutely fantastic. So maybe the best hidden history lesson so far. All right, you're going into such detail and explaining things that I'm sure fans have never heard before. I can't wait to hear what is on the next Knoxville card. All right, before we take our break, why don't you set us up with the Southeastern Gulf Coast card for the 4th of July week, and as we go back to 1980, set us up with that.
Okay, so that was it. It was the Southeastern Gulf Coast card. It was what we call the 4th of July week because you didn't have just a great day, the 4th of July, but that week, middle of summer, was one of the best weeks in the year. Obviously, we're talking about this card in 1980, and it's going to be in the same card. It's going to be in all three of the major cities, like we did quite a bit. On Monday, June the 30th, it was going to be in Montgomery. On Tuesday, July the 1st, that card was going to be in Mobile. And on Friday night, July 4th, it's going to be right there in the Dothan Farm Center, man. So this was the original card. And because it was a holiday, there were 7 matches on the card. But when we get to the TV show after the break here, the new United States Junior Heavyweight Champion, Jerry Stubbs, was going to make some changes in his match and 2 other matches in the junior heavyweight department on that card. So let's take a look at this original card that was for the July 4th week down in the Southeastern Gulf Coast in the year of 1980. And it opened up with a scheduled babyface match. The returning Ricky Gibson into the territory was going to be wrestling into Ricky Fields, who was the son of Lee Fields out of Mobile. Charlie Cook was going to be taken on in a rare match for him, the Big C. He's going to actually be in the ring. Norvell Lawson was scheduled to face Sweet Brown Sugar again, this time in a no DQ match. And the winner of this match was going to be getting a shot at the United States Junior Heavyweight Champion. Then for the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship, Tony Charles was getting a return match against Jerry Stubbs. That's the guy who had beat him the week before for the belt. And also a return match for the Southeastern Championship, Tag Championship. Plowboy Frazier and Randy Rose, managed by the Big C, were going to be getting their second shot at Rob and I and our belts. Then in the last match, this time it was a no disqualification match. Gerald LaDuke was again facing Big Ron Bass, managed by Big C. And then in that seventh and last match for the Southeastern Championship, the Stomper, after losing the belt the week before, was getting a return match with the new champion, Bob Armstrong.
All right, that is a fantastic card, especially on a holiday week. Three championship matches, two special no DQ matches, and seven matches in all. So when we come back after the break, we'll take the break now. When we come back with all that going on, we're going to find out how you are going to get anywhere near all the people on this card even seen on TV. It could be a jumbled up TV show, but we'll find out. Much less involved in all the matches on TV. That's coming up when the Studcast continues. Stay with us. Hey, Studcast fans, in case you don't know, Ron's best-selling novel, Brutus, has become one of the best stories ever written. Don't take my word for it. Go to Amazon novel, Brutus, and read for yourself the amazing reviews of so many that have been chilled to the bone by the largest lion ever in captivity. It's widely compared to Jaws and is exactly that, but in the mountains rather than the ocean. The only place you can get an autographed copy is Ron's website, tnstud.com. Check it out now. At tnstud.com, click on Stud Store. It's the only place you can get an autographed copy personally autographed to you by Ron. It's only $29.99 with free shipping and worth every penny. Get yours today. All right, Studcast fans, welcome back into the Studcast. I can't wait to hear how you've handled this loaded TV show that you sort of set up for us right before the break, Ron. So how did the TV show open up on this July 4th week?
Well, it opened up, man, with a rousing welcome. Charlie Platt was inviting out the new Southeastern champion, Bob Armstrong, to join him at the set. And I knew how much fans loved Bob, but this championship win had kind of turned into a big celebration, especially between him and the fans, like no other I'd ever seen. So he started for the set, but he couldn't resist those screaming fans over on the bleachers. They were going nuts, man, seeing him with that belt he had. Now that it had been a long time since anybody but the Stomper had held that belt. So they were going crazy on the bleachers. And instead of him coming onto the set, he just went straight over to the bleachers. And, you know, what a great spontaneous start that was to the show. Those fans were all over him. And Charlie's over there, you know, saying, wow, this is great to see. Look at this, Bob. So when he finally got to the set, Charlie congratulated him for his big win. The fans in the studio continued their celebration. And meanwhile, the Mongolian Stomper is back there in the other dressing room in the studio watching the celebration on the monitor. And he decided, I guess he took it upon himself. He said, well, enough is enough of this stuff. So the Stomper was already upset about losing his belt, you know, and Bob was carrying that belt around and bragging about it a bit. And Stomper was scheduled for the very first TV match, and he didn't wait until he should have been coming out. He couldn't wait, I guess. He just busted out of the dressing room. Big C was kind of chasing behind him on his coattails, like, wait a minute, where are you going? and then you can guess where he headed, straight for the bleachers, man. While that fan celebration and all that great happiness was going on out there, and the bleachers turned to havoc and horror, man. They just went nuts. Wow, and it was instant pandemonium, as usual. and bodies were flying in all directions. And Stomper, he was so upset that he went up into one of the bleachers and he emptied that bleacher entirely. And once he got into the middle of the bleachers, that bleacher was, there was nobody sitting there. So the Big C finally pulled him off the bleachers and he got him into the ring for the first TV match, which was about time, thank goodness. And it was obvious that Stomper was enraged by the fact that, you know, Bob Armstrong had taken not only the TV trophy from him about a month or so earlier, but now he had his coveted Southeastern belt too. So when the other wrestler made it into the ring that was supposed to be wrestling Stomper, it didn't take long for the Stomper to do, as I guess Terry Funk used to put it this way, to stomp a mud hole in his opponent. And that's basically what he did. He stomped a mud hole in the poor guy that he was wrestling. And so Bob and Charlie, they barely had enough time to even talk about the great 4th of July week card that we had talked about earlier. Before the Big C had to drag the Stomper away again, Stomper won the match, and he was going for the bleachers again for a second time, and Big C had to grab him, get in front of him like, whoa, whoa. You know, so it was kind of a little pandemonium in the first of the show.
All right, good deal. So now that was, that, to me, that's how you start a TV show. And that's what I would expect if I were going to sit down and watch wrestling. All right, so Stomper was really upset and back to rioting the studio crowd, which on it came across so funny to watch the crowd on TV. All right, so I'm sure the Big C loved it too. All right, so who was on the next TV segment?
Well, it was the Big C with Stomper and Randy Rose, Plowboy Frazier. I mean, he brought three of his guys out there. And now, you know, Big C showed up out there. He was as fired up as the Stomper was in that first segment of the show. So Big C was sitting down with Charlie at the set, and Stomper was cranking his big truck shock and standing behind Randy Rose. And then beside Stomper was the giant Plowboy. And he had those big wide eyes, man. He was standing next to Stomper, patting him on the back while he's cranking on that tire shock. And Big C, he wasn't wasting any time. He had plenty to say. He started with Bob Armstrong. And he talked about how Bob Armstrong had lied to him on the last TV show. He said he would put up his TV trophy. And he promised him that he would tell him who the mystery wrestler was who was supposed to go against his Texan Ron Bass in the last week. And he said it turned out to all be lies. And it was just to get Armstrong a title shot. You know, he basically traded him that to get Bob a chance to get the belt. And Big C was mad. He said, basically, he stole the belt from my Stomper. And he said, but it really didn't matter. He said, because Stomper was going to win his belt back. And he was going to do some real damage in the process to Bob Armstrong during this 4th of July week. So, you know, and you know how Carson was, I mean, the Big C. He was very mouthy, and he'd run out of air sometimes. So he caught his breath, and he continued, and he started talking about LeDuc. And he said that crazy Joe LeDuc was totally nuts. He said, especially since Ron Bass had busted his head open a couple of months ago. And he says, I think some of his brains drained out with the blood that came out of his head. And he said, now he's back. And he says, he's crazier than ever. And he said, but that don't really matter anyway. He says, because Ron Bass still got his bull rope and it's still got that big steel bell attached to it. And he says, and he's going to go to the ring he's going to ring that idiot Canadian's brain all over again on the 4th of July week. And so then it got to be mine and Rob's turn. You know, he tore into us. And he started off with something like, he said, the full of it, Fuller Brothers, well, which is at that point, you know, he said, for now they're the tag champions, but he says, they're not going to be that for very long. He says, you know, he was going to be in Plowboy and Randy Rose's corner. And if they didn't get the job done this time, he said, and they don't win the belts and get them back for me, he says, He said, I'm going into the ring myself, and I'm going to leave both those fellas laying on the 4th of July week.
All right, so it sounds like he was on a roll, no doubt. A little hot under the collar, but ready to win back some belts, even if he had to do it himself.
Yeah, right. So and he wasn't through, Dave. So he went and slapped all three of those guys on the chest, Ben. And then he told Charlie, he said, you know, Charlie, he says, since this is the 4th of July week, he says, I'm going to set up, I'm not only going to be bringing the fireworks, he said, I'm going to be the fireworks.
All right, you had to love Don Carson sometimes anyway. All right, so how about the second TV match?
Well, Rob and I, it was our second week of Southeastern Tag Champions, and Charlie asked the Big C if he wanted to stay and watch the opening match. And he declined, saying, you know, basically he said, if I let my men loose before the 4th of July, he said, that'd be starting too early. And he said, but luckily for those punks, you know, for Rob, talking about Rob and I, he said, I'm going to save all of it for them next week. So Rob and I, you know, we waited for the Big C to get off the set and get his troops back to the dressing room. And then we went to the ring. We got ourselves a really nice entrance, a welcome from the fans. And we had the newly won belts on, and we got ourselves a big win, both of us. Got fuller leg locks on the opponents at the same time, and got a nice win for right there in the middle of the ring.
All right, good deal. All right, listen, personality profiles have been so good lately. So who was on this one this time?
Well, this one was going to be a first, man. It had two different wrestlers on the same profile. I don't think we had done that before. Tony Charles was sitting there with Charlie when the profile opened up, and they were going to watch what was an extremely controversial win by the fan favorite Jerry Stubbs over Tony Charles from the night before. Right there, we're talking about Dothan's, you know where that TV station is, WTVY. It's not that many miles from the Dothan building out there where Stubbs won the belt the night before.
Yeah.
So Tony got a big hand when he was introduced by Charlie. And what fans at home were about to see, I can tell you, was going to change everything that they felt about Jerry Stubbs. I mean, they were shocked, those that didn't see it. Now, Tony had a busted eye on this. You could see that right away. And it was compliments to Jerry Stubbs. He had a few stitches put in it the night before. And so Charlie called for the video. And so the studio crowd, many of them had seen the match live the night before. But when he called for the video, I mean, everybody shut up on the bleachers over there. It was like, wow, they kind of knew what was coming, man. And it had been a very clean and scientific match up to the point where the video started. But then it showed Tony Charles and the referee had accidentally collided and both of them went down. And Jerry Stubbs took that opportunity, standing there right over Tony Charles, and he was wearing a new pair of wrestling boots, something that you had never seen him wear before. And one of those boots appeared to be a little larger than the other one. So he bent over, you know, Charles is laying there trying to get up. The referee's, he's down big time. And so, you know, he bent over and he pulled something from that boot that looked like it was a little bigger than the other one. And he put something on his hand and he waited for Tony to get up. And while the referee was still laying there and kind of trying to get his faculties about him. And when Tony did get up, Stubbs hit him, man, with whatever was on his hand. Tony went down face first, out cold, and in a puddle of blood, basically. And so Stubbs replaced the object, put it back in his boot. He rolled Tony over onto his back, and then he just stood there. When the ref finally got back to his feet, Stubbs just bent down, would put a knee into Tony's chest, and the ref counted Charles out. And many of the bleacher fans reacted with boos at that point. They couldn't hold it back anymore. And Tony didn't have much to say about it, other than the fact that he basically said, you know, I couldn't believe Jerry Stubbs could do something like that to me. He goes, We've been friends for years. So Charlie thanked Tony for coming on. And then he said, if you don't mind, Tony, I'm going to be speaking to somebody else. So Tony left the set. And then Stubbs asked for Jerry Stubbs to come on with him. And Jerry came out of, for the first time ever, Jerry had never been a heel, I don't believe, in his career to this point. And he came out of, for the first time ever, the heel dressing room on the far side of the studio. And fans in the bleachers, for the first time ever, they booed him. It was pretty amazing to see fans booing Jerry Stubbs. And he was carrying with him the United States heavyweight belt. And he was smiling like a Cheshire cat, man, that just swallowed a canary. I mean, it was all grins, man. And so Charlie's first question after Stubbs sat down was, Jerry, how long have you and I known each other? And so Stubbs says, too long for me, Charlie. I mean, he started right away, man. And he said, don't dare lecture me, Charlie Platt. Because he knew that, nobody liked what they had just seen in that video. And then he said, Charlie says, I've been hanging around the wrestling world too long to wait anymore for belts to come to me. He said, from now on, I take them. I'm going to take the belts.
Wow.
So then he continued, and he said, now, he says, I finally am the United States Junior Champion, and I'm going to call the shots from here on out. And he said, starting right now, and on this coming 4th of July week, he says, I'm scheduled to defend this title against Tony Charles in a rematch. And he says, that isn't going to happen, maybe ever. And he said, he's going to have to earn a shot at my belt already. It was my belt. And he said, I'm going to defend my belt only when and where I want to and against who I want to. He said, in fact, my first title defense is going to be against Ricky. So Charlie assumed he meant Ricky Gibson, Charlie says, I don't know, if that's going to happen for you or not. He says, Ricky Gibson is a very good wrestler, so Stubbs starts laughing. He goes, oh, no, I don't mean Ricky Gibson. I mean Ricky Fields from Mobile, the guy that hardly gets on the card anymore. And while we're at it, he says, in this little discussion here, he goes, the winner of the Norvell Austin and Sweet Brown Sugar match next week is definitely not going to be getting a shot at my belt anytime soon. And he continued on. He says, things are never going to be the same here again, Charlie, when it comes to my championship belt, he goes, and in which I'm going to be back in the dressing room right now in a few minutes to polish it a little bit more. And then he ended up saying, basically, he said, it's been your pleasure, Charlie Pat, all of course. And he got up and left the set to what was now, at that point, everybody in the studio was booing him. He was no doubt now what Jerry Stubbs had turned into.
I love how you recreated that exchange between Charlie Platt and Jerry Stubbs. And if you check it out on Facebook, on Charlie's page or Jerry's page or my page, only a couple of weeks ago in Headland, Alabama, I had lunch with both of those guys, and we just had a ton of fun. And Jerry was showing pictures, Charlie was telling stories, and I was just sitting there soaking it all up. But that was so much fun, that exchange from July of 1980. What a change in attitude. That is getting some heat real quick. I do remember Jerry Stubbs when he became a heel. He was a great wrestler either way, but he really was hated as a heel. All right, so now let's move to the next match. Who was in the ring next?
Well, the guy that was in the ring next was the guy that just got mentioned a few minutes ago, Ricky Gibson, who was another great junior heavyweight.
Yeah.
Wow, we were filled with junior heavyweights with him. They were all good. And this was just his second week in Southeastern. So, he's getting on TV in his second week. And during his match, the personality profile had just ended. That kind of opened the floodgates for this junior, for the junior heavyweights in the territory to come to the set and to talk to Charlie about what the heck just happened, basically, with this Jerry Stubbs interview. And they started showing up one at a time. Sweet Brown Sugar was the first one that got there. And he was extremely angry. He was asking Charlie, Charlie, is Jerry Stubbs, does he think he's the booker now or what's going on here? You know, he says, just because he's got the junior heavyweight belt, he said he was calling, I'm going to be calling Don Curtis. He goes, I'm going to lodge a complaint. I'm got to confirm that Jerry Stubbs ain't calling the shots here when it comes to the United States Junior Championship. So because that's why he said, that's why I came here to begin with. I came here to get my hands on that belt. And he goes, it's definitely going to happen. I am going to get my hands on it. So, you know, he left the set. And, Ricky Gibson up there in the ring, he was probably having a little bit of trouble focusing on what was going on with this parade of junior heavyweights. We're going to the set. Norvell Austin, as soon as Brown Sugar gone, Norvell, he shows up and he starts in. Without surprise of this instant transformation of Jerry Stubbs. And he says, how far out there, look how far he went to win the belt. Did you see what he did? No. So then he added that, he had won it. He said the fact he won it is absolute proof of how important the championship was, this belt around the world, and that surely Don Curtis wasn't going to allow Jerry Stubbs to run the show just because he had stolen the belt. He kind of got his way but it was Tony Charles who was the last one there, and he really had the best reason for being upset. And he said he'd been robbed of a belt, that he had held so long that many wrestlers considered it kind of be Tony Charles's belt, and he said the way he lost it, he said it was a testament to the value of what the wrestlers would do to get it. And he hated to think Jerry Stubbs really had the power to change the card and deny him the right of a rematch. Because how could Jerry Stubbs say, I'm not going to get a rematch for the title? So, and then he said, especially when you consider Charlie, the way I lost it, in such a horrible way.
Wow. All three of those guys really had a good reason to be mad. I recall, I think it was a couple of studcasts ago, you were saying the junior heavyweight wrestlers in the territory were about to become very relevant. So I think they just did on this particular TV show. All right. So how did Ricky Gibson's match end up?
Wow. Well, it ended up, man, with one of those beautiful drop kicks off the top rope. It instantly reminded me of my cousin, Jimmy Golden, man. I'll never forget.
Wow.
I thought right away about Jimmy.
Yeah. And both were very exciting to see. And I remember seeing Ricky Gibson many times as a kid in the Farm Center days. All right. So how about the last TV match? Take us there.
Well, the surprise of the last TV show, which was Joe LaDuke, nobody knew he was there until the last match. He was in this match on this card and on this TV. And wow, what a reception he got. I mean, everybody in that place just stood up when he came out of the dressing room. They were happy to have big old Joe LaDuke back, except, of course, for the guy that was standing across the ring from him, his opponent. And he wasn't so happy to see Joe. But when the match started, the Big C came back to the set. And he brought with him Ron Bass this time. Bass didn't come the first time he was there. So this time he comes back, he brings Ron Bass. And Ron Bass has his bull rope. And even though Charlie had not invited him there, they went anyway. So Big C tore into basically discussing the character of Joe LaDuke and Bob Armstrong. You know, how Bob Armstrong was a liar and Joe LaDuke was a brain dead Canadian, and he says he can't believe that they even put him in the ring anymore. I mean, the man is crazy. And they said it was time for the belts to go back on his men and time for his Texan to retire the Canadian permanently. that he was proud of Jerry Stubbs. He mentioned Jerry Stubbs. He said, Jerry Stubbs saw the light. And then now he's taking away the little limey Tony Charles's belt. Because I love it. You know, and he said, that it's just the beginning. He said, it's the beginning of what's going to happen the rest of this summer. He said, by the time this summer is over, all my men are going to have the belts and all the money. And then he said, you know, Charlie, he says, I might even make enough money to buy Southeastern Wrestling before the summer's over. About that time, Joe LeDuc put his bear hug on the opponent in the ring, and he started swinging him, as Joe used to do when he got that bear hug, from side to side, and the guy's arms were just flailing. Looked like a puppet up there. And so everyone in the studio was about to hear him scream, though. You know, the guy that was in the bear hug, and you could hear him scream. Everybody, and I guess everybody downtown Dothan heard him say, I give up, I give up. And, you know, but so did Ron Bass, who's standing there with the bull rope. And, you know, he didn't have anything to do, man, but to take that moment, boy, he charged the ring. And so Joe saw him coming, and, you know, he dropped his opponent like a bad habit. And they went over the ropes on the side of the ring where Bass was coming running from, and he sat down on the middle rope, and he pushed up the top one, and he waved for Bass to come on in. And the studio crowd exploded, man. Bass almost fell down trying to stop because he was about to run into him. And Big C kind of ran by to grab Bass, and he got him back to the dressing room before Big Joe LeDuc got his hands on him. And boy, there was a big roar of boos from the crowd again.
Oh, no doubt. All right, it was a good time. It was a real good time to be a Southeastern fan. Bob Armstrong, still the TV champion, had just won the Southeastern belt. Joe LeDuc had just returned from really out of nowhere to get even with Ron Bass, and it was another tremendous TV. Absolutely. All right, so what happened on the three nights this same card appeared in all three major cities?
Well, it gave us an opportunity, man, to do the videos from different buildings because the cards were the same in all three buildings. We just picked a match from each building and recorded them. And we did one match, like I said, from each of the cities. So in Montgomery on Monday night, we recorded the Southeastern Championship match between Bob Armstrong and the Mongolian Stomper. On Tuesday night in Mobile, we recorded the Joe LeDuc against Ron Bass. They had a special no disqualification match. That match was shot on Tuesday, and on Friday, July 4th in Dothan, Southeastern tag title with Rob and I against Plowboy Frazier and Randy Rose were done. We're going to cover all those matches in great detail in next week's TV show. Three of the four matches on that big card were changed by Jerry Stubbs in the personality profile of this TV, right? So the opening match changed from Ricky Gibson versus Ricky Fields to Ricky Gibson versus Tony Charles. And then that match ended up in a 20-minute time limit draw. Second match on the new card, basically, I guess you'd call it, the Big C was still facing Charlie Cook, and the Big C won the match over Charlie Cook. In the third match, Norvell Austin was still wrestling Sweet Brown Sugar. But the winner was no longer getting the title shot the next week at Jerry Stubbs and the U.S. Junior Championship belt. Norvell and Brown Sugar both got disqualified in their matches. Then Jerry Stubbs, he had the new United States Junior Heavyweight Champion. He wrestled Ricky Fields, and he won easily.
Okay, so I still don't know why Don Curtis allowed Jerry Stubbs to make some changes to the original card. I mean, so what kind of authority did he have, I guess, is the question.
Well, you know, it's almost like Jerry Stubbs knew something. That was actually because Jerry Stubbs had won the belt just the night before on the TV and on this TV show. They showed that match back. And Don Curtis and his wife were on vacation in Mexico.
Aha.
And it couldn't be reached by phone either.
Okay.
So it's like Jerry Stubbs says, oh, look, what a great time for me to decide who I'm going to defend against.
That answers that. Okay, so I can't wait to hear what Don Curtis has to say to Jerry Stubbs in the next Studcast. All right, so how about the attendances for this card in the three major cities? How'd you guys do?
Well, all three cities had sellouts, man, and actually turned fans away in all three cities. Montgomery had 5,000. Mobile had the 5,600. That was the limit that they would allow us to put in there. And Dothan had almost the same as Mobile at 5,400 in that red-hot Houston County Farm Center.
Been there many times, and, man, when there was a big night, it was a big night in that Farm Center. All right, so I know from experience that it was hard to take that building's heat with no air conditioning, especially after the sun beating down on that steel roof all day. And again, we're talking about like this time of year right now, July. So, I mean, I did that many times. It's hard to believe, Stud, but I think we may have time. Let's do a learning tree question. You got one set up for us?
I hope so, my man. Tell me what you got.
Okay, so the question comes from Phil Leneau in the Maritime Provinces of Canada. He asked, perhaps you could elaborate on the difference in weight class between the junior and heavyweights. Was it more of a visual size difference? Junior titles were never, to my knowledge, a thing in the Maritimes, he says. Maybe it was more of a Southern wrestling title. I became even more intrigued, though, when you alluded to bringing in the World Junior Champion as a special event.
He's got several questions there.
Indeed,
you know.
Yes.
Mr. Lino, you have some interesting questions here. It kind of surprises me that you didn't have any junior heavyweights in your part of Canada. I don't know how that could happen, especially since I know Les Thatcher wrestled in the Maritimes way back in the day.
Wow.
Because he and I rode down the road together a lot, and he used to tell me about that, you know, and Les Thatcher was a perfect junior heavyweight size. So you had junior heavyweights there. You just didn't, I guess, have any junior heavyweight champions. So I guess the difference between a junior heavyweight professional wrestler and a heavyweight is pretty simple, Mr. Leneau. You got a junior heavyweight can only weigh no more than 230 pounds. And it didn't have anything to do with his visual size or guessing how much the guy weighed. When you had a junior heavyweight championship match, you weighed those guys before they went in the ring so that you knew that they weren't over weight limit. And as far as being a Southern wrestling thing, it was far from that, basically. Probably some of the best junior heavyweight champions ever came out of Oklahoma. You had Leroy McGurk, who was way back in the 40s and 50s, a tremendous world champion. You had the Briscoe brothers. Both of those were junior heavyweight size. And you have had the obviously Danny Hodge, man. And all three of them were spectacular. So I had four of them here, basically, are spectacular wrestlers, you know. And you could hold a heavyweight title even if you were a junior heavyweight, if you were good enough to win it. And Jack Briscoe's a great example of that. Jack Briscoe, I don't think, ever went very much over 230 pounds in all of his career as the heavyweight champion. So my grandfather's brother, Herb Welch, won the World Junior Heavyweight Championship in the 1940s, and he held it undefeated for 5 years. And then he had a car wreck, man, a terrible car wreck, and he had to give up the title. So my family's even had a little bit of a World Junior Championship connection. And as far as I mentioned the World Junior Heavyweight Championship on the Studcast, I certainly did. And with all that was going on now in Southeastern in this time frame in 1980, with all these junior heavyweights now, we were going to be bringing in the World Junior Heavyweight Champion, Les Thornton. seven stud casts, basically. I looked in to see how many weeks in advance. We're 7 weeks away from Les Thornton coming in with the World Heavyweight Junior Championship, and he's going to be wrestling against the United States Junior Heavyweight Champion for his World Championship.
Wow.
So thanks for your question, Mr. Lano, and I hope I've cleaned up some of what you asked.
I tell you what, these studcasts are getting more amazing every week. You took us on a deep dive into booking and how to evaluate wrestling, the wrestling business in the Tennessee territory, then to a great card, another super TV show, and ended with a history lesson about junior heavyweight wrestlers for a man in Canada. So I mean, I'm telling you, nobody does what you can do. I can't wait to hear what's coming next. It's going to be fun to get to the next studcast.
Well, we're going to be going back basically to the next one, man, to Knoxville for another one of these hidden history lessons. We'll be evaluating the next wrestling card there. And, you know, we're going to spend some time in a lot of these on Knoxville again, talking about that situation. It's a really bad situation there. And then, you know, when the old saying, you know, when the cat's away, the mice will play. Well, the big cat Don Curtis is coming home the next week. Jerry Stubbs ain't going to be a happy boy. He's going to regret his big day. And the Southeastern card was loaded again, and it had a three-man junior heavyweight match, pitting three of the best in the world against each other to see who's going to get the next shot at the United States junior belt. The Big C joining forces with Randy Rose, and he's going to try to take away Rob and my Southeastern belts and so much more. So hopefully we have time basically again next week for another Learning Tree question too.
Man, you jam-pack them, and this has been a big, fun time, I'm telling you, for a studcast. Can't wait to get to the next one. Hey, folks, you know how to get up with Ron. On Facebook, find Ron at Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. Like and follow him there. Automatically become friends with a living legend. On Twitter or X, he is Ron Fuller Welch. Follow him there, too. Check out the fantastic website at tnstud.com. This studcast is going to be there with every studcast ever done. Shop the stud store where you can get 43 super studcast, four different 8x10 photos, the thrilling Lion novel, Brutus, personally autographed to you, and t-shirts still on sale for only $15.99, all with free shipping. And subscribe to Ron's YouTube channel, Southeastern Rewind. When you go to YouTube and put in the search bar Southeastern, it's the first thing that comes up, Southeastern Rewind. Find hundreds of hours of classic old school wrestling entertainment, 432 total videos, and the last 135 studcast, 16 Ask the Stud shows, and 115 short rides with the stud. Go back 1 year or more and discover fantastic stud stories about worldwide stars, 23 stud cast archive stories, 23 Tell Me More fan question shows, superstars of the past shows, and so much more. It's YouTube Southeastern Wrestling. You can spend weeks and weeks and still not see it all. It is the best deal in wrestling. Check it out on YouTube. All right, Stud, any final comments today?
Well, I really appreciate the nice comments I've been getting on my social media sites about these studcasts. And hope you enjoyed this one, everybody. And hope you come back and join us again next week. Please take care of yourselves and others. May God bless us all.
For Ron Fuller in the Great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee, I'm David Summers saying thank you for listening. Find me at davidsummersproductions@gmail.com. This studcast is a David Summers production for Tennessee Stud, LLC.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic studcast. The true story continues next week. So full Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.